Welcome to 45 North. I'm Ann Strangeamps here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. One of the grittiest memoirs in this season's crop of new books is by a Syrian-American writer and musician. We're listening to her right now. Her name is Ray Elias. Her new book is called Harley Loco, Hard Living, Hair, and Post-Punk, From the Middle East to the Lower East Side. Critics have described it as, well, my favorite description is Huck Finn on heroin, and a punk song disguised as a memoir. People who've struggled with substance abuse may recognize themselves on these pages. It is one of the most unflinching accounts of recovery from drug addiction that I've read. And Ray, welcome. It's so nice to have you join us here today.
Thanks so much, Jan, for having me.
So your book is getting talked about, as I just did, as a memoir about addiction. And, you know, of course, there's more to your life than a former drug habit. But as a story about substance abuse and recovery, what's different or distinctive, do you think, about your memoir?
Well, I mean, I think the difference is that, you know, my story comes from a core of not being able to speak English when I came here from Syria. It's just not about recovery. It's about core issues that we all go through, which actually led me to doing drugs. And so it's about family. It's about hope. It's about, you know, living to the extremes, the highs and the lows, and really just going for that ride.
Mm-hmm. You moved to the U.S. from Syria at a pretty young age. And today, of course, we see pictures in the news of Syria showing broken cities and a lot of devastation. But how do you remember life there?
Life was wonderful there, as I remember it. I mean, you know, we lived in a wonderful sort of marble flat and had a courtyard that we played in, and we went to the country over the summers and rode horses, and, you know, it was really pretty wonderful. And so I was just there 3 years ago, and it was just as beautiful and seemed like it was really on the brink of becoming, you know, sort of crossing that line and becoming something even more. And then, you know, the devastation has been happening. So it's really sad.
Yeah. Your family left for political reasons?
We left. I mean, most of the reason that my family left, my father was really, really a believer in education. And in the 60s, in the late 60s, a lot of nationalization was going on. So the government was starting to take land and just really nationalize everything. So, you know, I think my dad had the wherewithal at the time and the foresight to say, you know what, I think that my family can become better educated and we can have a better life in the future in the United States, like most immigrants feel. And he was right.
He was really successful in Syria, though, right? Wasn't he a pretty successful businessman?
Very, very, very successful. Very successful. But I think when he saw that, you know, the government was coming in and taking land and taking over things in general, but especially his land, you know, that would have really taken away his means of making money. And he didn't want my brothers to be enlisted in the army. I mean, he just really, you know, when I think about my dad and my mom, I think they just had, you know, that foresight. I remember my mother wanted to move to Lebanon because her sisters lived there. And he was like, no, 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 we're not going there either. We are, you know, we're going to the United States. My uncle lived in Detroit, so that's where we went.
Well, like so many immigrants, you know, you came here, your family, hoping for a better life. You know, of course, there are good things and bad things, but it was sort of a shock. You have this both hilarious and also totally heartbreaking story about, I think it was one of your very first nights in your new home. you should tell that story.
About Halloween?
Yes. Yes.
Well, so we were about 2 weeks in. None of us spoke English. And I'm the youngest of my family. And I was about not even eight yet. And so we hear a knocking. You know, we had food. We ate. The sun was going down. And we hear this banging on the door. And my father opens it. And I'm thinking, you know, we don't know anybody here. Nobody knows that we're here. What's going on? And he opens the door and there's these little monsters, basically monsters, just saying, "Rate, rate, 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 rate." And I'm like, what? My father's yelling in Arabic first, then in French. And we're all sort of huddled up behind him, and he slams the door, and then they're banging again, and he opens it, and we look down the sidewalk, and there's more coming, and then there's big ones at the end of the sidewalk, and, you know, and he's shaking the screen door, and he's trying to get rid of them, and then he said, "No, you go, we don't speak English," and shut the door, and he threw us all in the bedroom, and we were all sitting there just literally shaking, and he stood guard all night. We didn't know what the hell was going on. And the next day my uncle came in, so the sun was going down again, and we were getting all freaked out because in the morning when we woke up, you know, the bushes and the trees were toilet papered and the windows were soaked up, and we just had no idea why we were under attack. You know, and it was the 67 riots, so we were like, what is going on? You know, are we being attacked? Did they move from Detroit to Royal Oak? And my uncle walked in at sundown. We were all huddling up again because we were afraid of what was going to happen that night, the following night. And he walked in and just started belly laughing, just ache, you know. We're like, what? Get in, hurry, hide. He was like, "Darlings, it's Halloween. They were asking for candy. They were saying trick or treat." And I still don't have a great relationship with Halloween. I mean, I just was so traumatized as a kid. But yeah, that's what it was like.
It is. It's both funny, and that's really heartbreaking. I mean, not only were you terrified, but, you know, along with the eggs and the toilet paper, I think there were also, you know, mean things soaped on your walls.
Yes. A lot of very, very racial slurs and, you know, weirdos and freaks.
Like, welcome to America. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, that's basically when I realized, as innocent as this holiday is, we're still very different. I was so, so conscious of being so different here. Yeah.
And you had been in Syria. I mean, the portrait you paint of yourself is you were a very outgoing, bubbly, social little girl, kind of a class leader. You were, you know, you always had kids kind of following you. And then you get here and it goes from the Halloween story to, you know, it kind of only gets worse in school. There was, I wanted to ask you about this short film you made recently. It's called The Lunchroom. Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe you can describe what happens in the film.
Well, I mean, you know, my mother was this amazing sort of chef. Now you would call her a chef. She just cooked for us. But with all the gastro restaurants now that are out, it's like everything on their menus that you see now is what we had when we were kids, stuffed in pita bread. So whether that was, you know, sliced lamb tongue or fried lamb brains or mortadella or whatever it was, and she would make these wonderful lunches and send us to school. You know, these were delicacies. And I remember going to school dressed in a little leopard tunic that she had sewn right out of French Vogue, and with these little patent leather Mary Jane shoes. And she just thought I looked so cute, and I thought I looked so cute. And went to school, and the kids just ate me up, you know, because everybody in Warren was in Jordache jeans and a sweatshirt, and they just didn't get it. And so I went to school this one day, and, you know, and I was sitting at the end of the table, and everybody was asking, "What do you have?" And they're like, "Bologna, salami, peanut butter and jelly." And I couldn't speak English. And they're like, What are you eating? Because pita bread wasn't popular back then. I mean, nobody even knew what it was. And the French translator, who was my teacher, came and she said, "You know, what are you eating, Rhea?" And I said, "Well, fried lamb brains and a sandwich." And she was like, "Excuse me?" And I said, "It's a delicacy." I said, "Fried lamb brains and a sandwich." And the table just cleared out. These kids looked at me like if I was, you know, a Martian alien, you know, crazy. It was like, ew, And then, of course, I had cooties and I had, you know, I mean, I was called Brain Lamb Brain Head and Big Bananas and I don't know how many names they made up for me. But, yeah, it was pretty tough. Well, I never ate lamb brains again. I have to tell you that.
Oh, or at least not in public. But I was thinking, you know, going back to the Halloween thing, you know, the theme here is who's the monster, right? You know, I mean, the kids in the neighborhood treated you in a way that was monstrous, but they also saw you, I guess, as some kind of monster.
Yeah. I mean, Warren, Michigan back then, you know, was just very white and blue collar and, you know, and we came in, I think we were kind of like the first, I think a lot of the Arabic families were going to Dearborn, and we sort of moved first to Royal Oak and then to Warren, and it was really, I felt really different. Everybody had blonde hair, blue eyes, you know, most people, and yeah, kind of with the clothes and the language and the looks, kind of stuck out like a sore thumb, and really started becoming ashamed of who I was as a Syrian. So I was never really Syrian enough, but yet I wasn't American enough. I really wanted to be American and fit in so badly.
So there's the setup, I guess, right? You know, this huge hole in your life torn by leaving Syria and then, you know, just over and over again, not being accepted, being demonized, and the really terrible bullying that you experienced. So at what point did you find yourself gravitating toward drug use?
Well, I mean, I didn't really expect to gravitate towards drug use. I guess like most people don't.
Yeah.
But I did want to fit in. And like you just said, you know, the hole was just getting bigger and bigger. And I really didn't know how to fill it. You know, I didn't know what to do to sort of become a part of. And there was one time when I was being teased really bad, and the kids gave me aspirin, but they told me it was something else, and they all started acting crazy. But I didn't feel anything, so I thought, oh my God, I better act crazy too because I don't want to be left out. And so I started acting crazy, and then they told me it was an aspirin, and I was a real idiot, and blah blah blah, and it was this big thing at school. And so I thought, well, I'm going to show them. You know, and when I realized at a young age that I couldn't be the best of the best, I made a decision to be the best of the worst. And I thought, okay, if there's one way to shine, this is how I'm going to shine. I'm going to do it bigger, better, badder, worse, harder than anybody could ever imagine. And that's how I'm going to separate myself and so get credibility. And so the following day I thought, okay, you guys thought you gave me a hit of mescaline. I'm going to go to the railroad tracks. I know it sounds cliche, but it's actually true. And I went to the railroad tracks with the dollar that my mom had given me for lunch that day, because I refused to take lunch to school anymore in junior high. And I bought a hit of mescaline and I dropped it right there in the morning at 8 o'clock and went to school. And boy, did I earn some credibility then for just like not freaking out in all my classes. Everybody knew I had done it because they saw me.
My God, so how old were you?
I was in the eighth grade. I think I was 12 years old.
You're 12 years old and you're freaking, well, not freaking, I guess. You're tripping on mescaline?
In school, yes.
In middle school?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
In middle school, yes. Don't do what I did to all those kids. I've done it for you. You don't have to do it.
Oh. So fast forwarding to the early 80s, especially the whole world of music and drug culture, and music became a huge part of your life then. These were, what, the punk years, post-punk?
Post-punk, yeah. I mean, I was into rock and roll as growing up, but then when punk came along and, you know, and Iggy and all those guys, and they're from Detroit, and I, you know, and I realized that, because I never really thought of myself as a musician, because when I took a couple of piano lessons and, you know, they would basically smack me on the hand and say, oh, she can't read music. So they'd send me home with my mom saying, she can't read music, so she can't play. But when I would go into lessons, I couldn't look at the music because for some reason it scrambled my brain. Mm. And this is before the drugs. But there was something, you know, inherently like backwards about the way that, you know, I still think I have a little bit of dyslexia because I speak backwards because I think in Arabic. I translate into French sometimes and then go into English. So sometimes things are really backwards for me. So I read backwards and I couldn't really read music. But when I closed my eyes, I could listen to something once or twice and then play it. So I would go into my music lesson and just close my eyes and play it. And they'd be like, no, 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 you have to read it. The moment I would look at the music, I would get confused and I couldn't play. So I didn't think I was a musician, but when I started listening to Iggy and the New York Dolls and all these guys, you know, that couldn't, and Sex Pistols, that couldn't really play their instruments, but were making this incredible music that was on a visceral level that was moving people, I was like, wow, I think I can do that. And so post-punk, you know, was like 1980. And I picked up my mother had bought me a piano that I would like pound on and I would beat her pots and pans to death, like trying to play drums. And so she bought me an old Slingerland drum set and put it in the sunroom and I would just pound away. And then I got an electric keyboard and started learning these riffs and eventually bought a drum machine, blah, blah, blah. And created like a wall of sound on my own started playing.
We're talking with Ray Elias. She's the author of Harley Loco, a memoir of hard living, air, and post-punk from the Middle East to the Lower East Side. Ray, I want to come back and talk a little bit more about the connection between music, rock and roll, post-punk, and drug use. But in the meantime, you can join our conversation if you're listening along. It's 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Did you have a role model, perhaps, who glamorized addiction or made substance abuse seem less dangerous? Do you feel like there's a connection between rock and roll and music and drug use? You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Ann Strange Hemps, and this is 45 North on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with Ray Elias this hour. She's a musician, and author of a new memoir, Harley Loco. And Ray, so we were talking about music and, you know, your early experimentation with drugs, which sort of just developed as you got deeper and deeper into the music. So these were the 80s, big years, I guess, for cocaine, crack, ecstasy?
Yeah. You know, when crack hit in 1984, I was already in New York, and it was like instantly and overnight, things really, really changed. And it went from being, you know, seeing your neighbor as a mom with three kids, taking care of her kids, to your neighbor with three kids, like, you know, selling herself on the corner for the next vial of crack. I mean, things instantly changed, instantly in New York. But the ecstasy was legal back then. I mean, it was legal. And I, you know, I acquired the name in Detroit of Madam X, just like not... I used to bring it back here a lot because I used to do a lot of shows back in Detroit after I moved to New York. And so that was the love drug, you know, it was before the crack hit. And that was the love drug back then until, you know, your brain felt like it was being dislodged from your skull. And so it all went hand in hand, Jan.
But do you feel like, I mean, I guess, what was the lure? What did you love so much about being wasted?
Not feeling like I was in my own skin. I was so uncomfortable in my own skin back then that anything to soften the edges, anything to get out of myself. I mean, I feel like I was looking for a spiritual solution back then to that hole and the pain that I was feeling inside. And, you know, my first thing was the drugs. Then it was like, oh, my God, music is the solution. I mean, music will always be the solution for me. But I didn't know that back then. And I was just looking for anything to make me feel comfortable in my own skin.
At what point did you realize that you weren't just experimenting with or using drugs? You were actually addicted. You had a habit.
I didn't know that for a very long time. I mean, the first time I really, really knew was when I came back. I'd been living at Tompkins Square Park in New York. It was called Tent City back then. I was homeless. I'd been, you know, I'd really risen up in the music industry and the hair industry. I was, you know, a rock star fashion person, and then really spun out. And
God, that's quite a sweep, because I mean, you'd gone from like going to parties with Andy Warhol and doing the hair for Vogue magazine fashion shoots, right?
Absolutely. And that's how quickly, you know, and before I realized that I was an addict, I just thought I was nuts. I just thought, I am completely incapable of having normalcy in my life. I don't know how my brothers and sisters do it. I don't know how other people do it. For me, I just don't have that capacity.
Yeah, but that was part of your identity, right? That was a good thing. I mean, you're talking about a world in which living on the edge and being crazy and outrageous was good.
Absolutely. It was good until it wasn't anymore. Until it wasn't, you know, it's really good. It's really good when it's moderated. But for me, I just never had that. I never had that that line. I never had that boundary. And so I didn't realize that I was an addict. And then my sister came out and she, you know, she told me, you know, Rhea, come home, get some help. And when I'd really sort of pushed everything to the limit and was truly homeless, and they were closing the park and redoing it, I decided, okay, I'll go home. And the first counselor, I was on methadone. I was, you know, just a mess, as you can imagine. And
so at that point, you'd graduated from crack and ecstasy to heroin, then.
Heroin and cocaine, yes, intravenously. And when the counselor looked at me and said, you know, you're an addict, and there's a solution. It was like the sky had opened up. I was like, oh, my God, that's what's wrong with me? Like, I'm not just insane. There is a solution.
Was that a relief?
Now, it was such a relief. And yet I didn't know that I really wanted to stop, because the lifestyle was so addicting. And so it took me 7 years after I realized. And, you know, I feel like once you become aware, you can't become unaware.
Yeah.
So once I became aware of the fact that I was an addict, it was a painful, painful process to not want to get clean, because that even threw more shame on top of it. It's like, well, you know what you are. There's a solution. Why can't you just live in the solution? And it's like, I wasn't done. I needed it.
But what weren't you done with? I mean, you were homeless at that point. It sounds like your life was fairly miserable. So what was it that was appealing still?
Well, when I came back, Jan, I'm a really quick cleanup. So I would clean up and I would get my life together, and, you know, 6 months, 8 months, 9 months. And then I would think, oh, I'm great, you know, and I'd right back into the fashion industry. I'd start cutting hair. Start, you know, get a couple shows here and there, and, you know, 9 months a year would go by, and then I think, just one more, and the one would be two, and the two would be three, and then pretty soon I'd be into full-blown addiction again, and, you know, and I would end up, I mean, I only ended up in jails and institutions, OD'd three times. I mean, it's just I don't know. I don't know what that point is until you ride it out, where there's not another good story. There's not another anything left, except for me, I just realized, wow, I can't even die. Like, I can't even die. I can't stay dead.
Did you actually? I think I remember you said you OD'd three times. I think at least once you flatlined.
I flatlined, yes. I had to have Narcon and the paddles. And that wasn't even...
And that wasn't rock bottom?
That was not rock bottom. Can I tell you what my rock bottom moment was? I woke up in a room and I was alone and I had done enough to probably kill an elephant in one shot. And I didn't die. I woke up in the morning and Katie Couric was on the morning show. I'll never forget. I had the TV blaring and I woke up and I thought, am I in hell? Because it was like the room was in disarray. There was just needles and works and food uneaten and crazy stuff. And for a moment, my mother had passed away years before, about 4 years before. But for a moment, I saw myself as if she had walked into the room and saw me. And there was just a devastation in the clarity of that moment that made me think, wow, okay, I'm never going to stay dead. I'm always going to suffer. And if this is how people are seeing me, if this is what it really looks like from the outside, like, I better get it together because I'm just going to keep suffering. Like, what ended up as a party, the art scene, the music scene, Andy Warhol, Jean-Michel Basquiat, fashion, Vidal Sassoon, all of it ends up with me on a bathroom floor alone. That is not what I intended when I've started. And I didn't need any more rehabs. I didn't need any more detoxes. I just begged a friend for 7 days worth of Vicodin so I could just clean up myself. And that was the last time, and I've never looked back.
Wow. So you did that all on your own. So having...
I won't say on my own. I will never take credit for that. I did it with the help of my family. I started going to meetings to people that, you know, really embraced me.
But that decision...
That moment, that decision was definitely mine.
So do you have advice for people, and especially for family members of people who may be going through the same thing? And it's so frustrating for family members. You know, I'm thinking of your sister or your mother when she was still alive, you know, who were probably dying to say or something, anything that would get you to that point. Do you have any advice for other people?
I do. I mean, the only advice comes from personal experience. And I know that my sister stopped giving me money. My father stopped giving me money. They would not let me into their homes, but they never stopped believing. And they would come visit me if I were able to actually meet them out. They were a constant emotional support for me. And they were constantly trying to intervene, but like professionally intervene, like send her to a rehab, send her, no, you cannot come to my house and stay anymore. You've ripped us off too many times. You've taken money from our kids' wallet. You have, you know, you can't do this in our personal space anymore, but we won't give up on you because we still believe that there's something in there that's worth saving. And I think that's the most important thing that I could ever tell any parents is don't enable your children. Don't, or your friends, don't enable your friends. Like, we're all enablers and we're all such codependent. You know, we want to help and we just don't know how. But there is no help unless that person really wants it. I needed it for so long, but I didn't want it. And until I did, then I didn't really need anybody's help because there's help. There's professional help out there. But just knowing that my family, my sister didn't give up on me. My friend Anita didn't give up on me. You know, they were there emotionally, and if I ever needed to make that call, they would pick up the phone. I remember being at Rikers Island where I did some time and waiting to be sentenced, and I needed money in my commissary for, you know, a good toothbrush and some candy, because, you know, when you're a junkie, you need candy when you're not getting it. And I called my sister, and she was so like, no. And then I called my dad, this wonderful Syrian man. And I said, Daddy, I need money in my commissary. It doesn't have to come to me. It just, I need it in there so I can have cigarettes. And, you know, and he had heard it all by then. And he said, okay, Binti. Binti means daughter. He said, okay, Binti, I will send a $50 check to your commissary, but only if the guard puts it in. And I said, trust me, it won't ever get to me. It'll just go straight in there. And so, you know, they sent me that $50. It's like, okay, I'm in jail. I really need this. It's not going up the arm. And they were like, yes, we'll help you. And when you come out, if you're clean, we'll embrace you. But we won't embrace you if you're not.
You are you're blessed to have a really wonderful family. You've written some, and you've made at least one song about your relationship with your mother, which I know is maybe a big regret for you. She died before you recovered, and I guess there were kind of years there when you weren't really able to be there for her in the way you wanted now. How do you look back on your relationship with your mother?
My mom was the epitome of grace and beauty and warmth. And I, you know, people ask me if I have any regrets. And there's not a lot of regrets out there, but that is the one. I will never forget the day that I left, the last time that I saw her actually speaking to me. And she was sitting at the table crying, and I left and told her, you know, she had cancer, and we never really talked about it. And I told her that I loved her and that I wished she would talk to me about it. And then, you know, when I came back, she was already mostly in a coma. And she woke up and looked at me and said, "You came," and then went right back in. And those are things that that ride with me on a daily basis. They, you know, my mother was such a compassionate human being, and we had some really funny moments. She always wanted to be my friend, but I was never able to really allow her in because I was so afraid, and I was so homophobic about my own sexual identity that I was really afraid that, you know, she would not love me, not, you know, all that stuff that comes with being uncomfortable in your own skin. So I do have a huge regret, which, you know, I did show up for my father when he was passing away, and I was sober, and I gave him all of it because they were so connected. And I knew that the connection would run to her. I knew she was there looking over us. And when I apologized to my father for everything, he said to me, "Are you happy now?" And I said, "Yes, I am, Daddy." And he said, "Then I have done my job well." Mm-hmm. And you know, and I know that that's how she feels. She was always so proud of me, and I so proud of her. So, you know, last night at the DIA, people were asking, we had a wonderful reading. People were asking, how do you think your parents would feel? And I really feel like they would be so proud. I mean, there's nothing in that book that they didn't know. Well, maybe there's a couple things they didn't know, but they knew who I was, you know, and they were in their own way very proud of who I was as a person. They weren't proud of the things that I did, but I know deep down they always fought for me because they knew that I had a really, really independent spirit. And I was kind of like the both of them in many ways.
I'm curious, you know, you've been clean for a long time now, but who you are, the part of you that's an artist, that's a musician, that wants to break boundaries is still, you know, maybe the core part of who you are. which you had to kind of untangle from drugs. But looking back, you know, there's a reason that the world of drugs and the worlds of music and art are often intertwined. I mean, do you think, for you personally, have you made peace with the part of you that longs for excess, for some kind of transcendence, and the part of you that, you know, can't do that anymore?
I have found the way to make art and music and have transcendence. And I really believe, I don't long for the bumpers anymore. I don't long for the haze anymore, because I feel like I said before, I rode that out to its limits. And I really feel like at this point in my life, the reality is the edge. Like, the reality of life without substance is beyond transcendence. It freaks me out. I mean, it is like an acid trip gone wild. And you can, you know, for me, riding the wave of reality is way more exciting. I mean, what life brings is just so crazy. Like, drugs could never have an up on that, right? So the music now, I mean, it took me 3 years to really start making music again, because I didn't think that I could do it without having the substance. I really thought that, oh my God, Rhea, you're never going to be able to, you know, make another song that's like Hymn 1111 or Nothing Matters or any of that. And when I sat down and really started working, it was like, again, the music was my drug. And I could really quietly just dig deep, untangle all those demons, and really find solace in doing this. And, that's sort of where I am, yeah.
Rhea, thank you so much for sharing your story and being here with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rhea Elias is the author of Harley Loco, Hard Living, Hair, and Post-Punk from the Middle East to the Lower East Side. It's a new memoir just out. I'm Anne Strange-Champs, and you are listening to 45 North on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Anne Strange-Champs. You're listening to 45 North. Gaylord Shanilac. He is a book artist and an internationally celebrated wood engraver, and he lives in Stockholm, Wisconsin, where he owns a fine arts press called Midnight Paper Sales. And for about a decade now, he's been producing this series of hand-engraved, hand-printed books based on extremely close observation of things like local mayflies and fish. And his current project is called The River, Lac de Pleurs. Gaylord, welcome. I have admired your work for such a long time, and I'm so happy that we have a chance to talk.
And me. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. Well, so I wanted to start by asking you about your new book. This is called Lac de Pleurs, which means Lake of Tears in French. Where does the title come from?
It actually comes from Louis Hennepin, who was the first European to get that far up the river in 1680 with his story of being captured by the indigenous people when he first entered the lake. According to Hennepin, the Indian men cried all night long because they so wanted to kill him, but their chief said no. And so that's where the name came from.
And this is what we call Lake Pepin, right? Which is not technically a lake, I think.
Well, it's interesting because it's a lake with the Mississippi River running right through it. So is it a river? Is it a lake? It's an interesting question, I think.
And this is where you live, on Lake Pepin, near Lake Pepin?
We're about 3 miles from the lake.
Do you spend a lot of time on it?
Until I started this project, I'd never been on it. Even though I'd lived there for 20 years, I'd never actually been on the river. So, but in the course of the project, I bought an old aluminum-hulled Lund fishing boat and converted it into a sort of a floating studio. I have a drawing table. I have a little library, a camera compartment. I kind of custom made it for what I thought it would be like to be out on the river reading and writing and thinking and photographing things. And I was even going to be doing engraving and things out there. But once I got out there and started spending time, I found myself just getting so involved with what I was around me that I hardly ever use the drawing table, and I don't do a lot of reading out there. But instead, I do a lot of beach combing and photographing birds. And I do some fishing because I'm collecting specimens of different species of fish as part of the project.
So we should talk about what your project actually is. You're a wood engraver and a book artist, and you create these books that they're a little hard to describe. I sort of think of them as poems in book form. So what was it you were setting out to do with this one?
Sort of the point was that I had no idea what I was setting out to do. Never having been on the lake, knowing very little about it, having a boat and just sitting on the river and seeing kind of what happens. The first idea I had was, okay, I'm going to collect specimens of fish. But at the end of the first season, I realized that to catch all 70 species of fish and engrave them as I planned was going to take about 120 years.
There's 70 species of fish in Lake Pepin?
Approximately. At least that's what I've read.
Did that surprise you? It surprises me. It seems
that
like
there
a
were
lot
70
of
species?
It seems like a lot of
it, yeah,
of fish.
It is a lot of species.
Well, so what do you do when you're engraving a specimen, one of the fish that you've caught, for instance? There's this gorgeous engraving photo I've seen. It's I think it's called a red horse fish.
Right.
And you've made it look sort of mystical. It's suspended there above the lake. That's kind of looks like maybe it's a cloudy day. So how
right.
did you actually make that engraving?
Well, another of the things I've been spending a lot of time looking at are specimen prints from mostly European and mostly from the 18th and 19th century. Just in looking at these specimens, that a lot of the fish specimens were placed in the landscape that where they came from. And so with the shorthead, I took a photograph. Right when I caught the fish, I took a photograph of what I could see. And it was a really windy day. It's kind of a rough water. And so I ended up putting that in the background behind the fish when I did the engraving. But one interesting thing that happens when, like, I probably spent 300 hours just engraving the blocks for that fish, not to mention the printing time and all of that, but all those hours spent engraving, you know, scale by scale, hour after hour, I'm thinking about things like the overarching pattern to scales, you know, how there's kind of a perfection to it almost. But if you start looking closer, of course, you realize that absolute diversity reigns, that every scale is a unique individual. So I realized I was engraving portraits of unique individual scales. And when you think about that kind of stuff for 300 hours, it creates, it becomes like sort of a simmering pot. And, you know, all these ideas and images are simmering in there, and something arises from it that you can't quite put your finger on, but you can sort of sense it when you actually look at the image, I think.
Well, I was actually thinking about the way in which we see and interact with the natural world. I mean, we should talk a little bit about your other book, Mayflies of the Driftless Region. It was all about the different mayflies, and most of us, I think, I guess I had just assumed there was maybe one kind of mayfly. I didn't know there were enough to do an entire book of them.
Well, like this river project I'm working on now, I knew relatively little about mayflies when I started working on that project. So I just started collecting them and looking at them. I got a microscope and I began engraving images of them, colored images. And when I was finished with the specimen, I'd send it to an entomologist, Clark Gary, who taught up in River Falls at the university there. And he would examine the insect and put it through the entomological keys, and he would send me back an entomological identification. He'd bring it to species. And I just became fascinated with the language of entomology because, I mean, in a scientific document, it's pretty dry reading, but if you put it in a finely printed book that's taking hours and hours and hours of thought to do, it becomes almost poetic in nature, I think. I just love the language of it. And as this correspondence with Dr. Gary went along, sometimes, for one reason or another, he would fail to come to species. And the last thing that Dr. Gary wrote was, taxonomy is an extremely dynamic discipline. And he went on to explain that Ephemerella enormis, which was one of the first insects he had identified for me, was no longer Ephemerella enormis. They'd revised the keys and changed the name. So the whole idea was, or the whole thing that I took away from that was that science is fluid just like anything else, and that scientists and artists really do basically the same thing. They both observe the world around them and record their observations as best they can.
Well, that's what I mean, is that I think that we often don't realize how much diversity is staring us in the face. Until you did the mayfly project, you probably had no idea how many different kinds of mayflies there are.
I had no idea. And I had no idea what they were. They spend 90% of their lives in the larval stage, and they only exist as adults for 24 hours. Their mouthpieces don't even function as an adult. They just basically have sex and die. That's it.
They don't even eat.
They don't even eat. No, no.
What do you like about them?
Well, pattern. I mean, so much. Just what I was talking about before, the pattern that we, you know, that you see in an ear of corn, or that you see in the wings of insects. I mean, there's this beautiful pattern in nature that, like I was saying before, there's this diversity, absolute diversity when you look beneath the surface. And when you're engraving something like a mayfly's wing, I mean, there's this amazing pattern you're working with. But if you look, for instance, if you look at the opposing wing of that very insect, the right-hand wing will be different than the left. I mean, it's just amazing how different it is, at the same time how much the same things are.
Wow, it sounds like the pattern in a wing could be like a fingerprint.
Oh, yeah. It is. All of nature is like a fingerprint, I'm beginning to think. I mean, everything is just totally diverse. Huh. There are no two things that really are the same.
Well, I've heard you describe this as playful science. What does that phrase mean to you?
The difference between what I do and what a scientist does is that I don't have to prove anything, whereas in science, you're obligated to prove your theory or whatever. I don't have to. So it's more playful science. It's more for the fun of it. And I love science. I love collecting specimens and just sort of relating them to the rest of the natural world, but I don't have to prove anything. Mm. So that's basically where the playful science comes in.
Sounds like it harks back to an earlier age of natural philosophers like, you know, Darwin or Thoreau.
Actually, it does, and the term natural philosophy is kind of an interesting one to me, because that's what they were calling the field of science before you were required to prove anything. So it really does sort of apply to what I do in a playful sort of way.
Gaylord, thank you so much for talking today.
Well, you're welcome.
Gaylord Janelek is an internationally recognized book artist, a master wood engraver, and proprietor of the Fine Arts Press Midnight Paper Sales, which is located in Stockholm, Wisconsin. You can see some of his work on our Facebook page. That's 45 North on WPR. And while you're there, be sure to friend us. I'm Ann Strange-Sampson. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio.